Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News. This week's episode of Groundwire is a special edition for Prisoner Justice Day produced by Carly Forbes. In this edition, Peter Collins speaks about the co-optation of Prisoner Justice Day by the Correctional Services of Canada and about the censorship of a portrait he made of Ashley Smith. In Montreal, there was a demo and walking tour in solidarity with the prisoners of Pelican Bay that also highlighted local industries that profit off the prison industrial complex. And we will also feature the ongoing expansion of Stony Creek Prison just north of Winnipeg and Collins Bay Prison in Kingston. On the Community Radio Report, we will hear from folks who produce the show, Terra Informa. Here are this week's headlines. Justin Pichet, editor of the Journal of Prisoners on Prisons, speaks to recent legislation that has led to overcrowding of prisons.
In the last year or so, we've seen an increase of 1,000 prisoners in the federal penitentiary system. Now, this is largely resulting from pieces of legislation that have been put forward by the conservative government while they were in minority. So often, opposition parties would sometimes cooperate with the government to pass certain things. So for one, we have the Truth in Sentencing Act that was passed in 2009. That eliminated credit for time served in remand before trial and sentencing for prisoners. So that's creating a capacity or a prison population increase. We're also seeing a series of mandatory minimums, some of which were passed, others which are going to be placed in an omnibus bill in the fall. That's creating a whole series of longer sentences for different types of offenses. And we're also seeing, it's something I think is often overlooked in analyses on the federal penitentiary system, and I'm just as much at fault for this as any other analyst, is that we've seen a bunch of appointments to the judiciary, to parole, and Howard Sapers again mentioned today that we're seeing less people being released on parole than before, and this is a function of the people that the conservatives have put in place that are making decisions about parole. So we're seeing all these kind of different pressures being put on the federal penitentiary system. Now we're seeing some serious overcrowding issues, increases in the amount of double bunking, which is putting two people in a cell originally designed for one person. That rate is up from 10% this time last year to 13%. So it's also scheduled to rise up to 30%, according to some figures that have been released by the Correctional Service of Canada and the Office of the Correctional Investigator. So we're seeing some serious things happen inside prisons right now.
And now a press release from Julian Ickham and the support crew for Kelly. On Tuesday, August 9th, 2011, in provincial court in Toronto, the judge agreed to a bail variation for the G20 activist Kelly Flugbeck, which replaces her house arrest with a 10 o'clock curfew and allows her to have unrestricted contact with her fiancé, Julian Ickham, on the condition that he severs his ties with anti-poverty group SOS. These changes to her bail conditions come after a year-long effort by her lawyer, Stephen Gale, and community groups lobbying against the injustice of giving her some of the harshest conditions received by people arrested at the G20. Protests such as the one last Monday, August 5th, where about 16 people, many who worked with her, and others such as members of the Hamilton Steelworkers Local 1005, had a rally and ended up at the Crown Attorney's Office in Guelph with letters for the Attorney General demanding that conditions that keep her apart from loved ones and her community be removed have been happening all year in cities such as Guelph, Kitchener-Waterloo, and Victoria, BC. Kelly is still not allowed to associate with anyone who is known to have ties with SOS, whose Facebook group has more than 195 members, nor is she permitted to attend any public demonstration, which could include something as simple as the Sunday servings that SOS provides. And the fact that her association with her fiancé, Julian Ickham, rests on him severing his ties to SOS shows that the state is not interested in Kelly's guilt or innocence as much as they are dismantling anti-poverty groups such as SOS. When asked about severing ties with SOS, Ickham stated, quote, Clearly, this demonstrates that the issue is not about whether or not Kelly is guilty or innocent of mischief at the G20. Rather, it is about whether or not Kelly is an effective voice for anti-poverty community, a crime that in their eyes is more heinous than all of the smashed windows. I may be forced to quit SOS, but I can't be forced to quit activism. Guelph hasn't heard the last from us yet. End quote. That's it for the headlines. Here's Security Remix by Attract Random.
This security is not for me, no. This security is not for me, no. Humanity's a history of combat, mortal combat, fatal combat, from hand to hand and rules of engagement, to this madness, a war market, them wage war, via a profit and or land or water, nation, honor, religion, religion, religion. Watch the TikTok, watch the TikTok, technological, it's an advance, they. They call this progress. Progress is history. From this and sticks and stones to bows and poison tipped arrows, swords and armor, Chinese gunpowder, no more fireworks and water, bomb blasts and murder. Cannon ships bring guns and Bibles, divide and conquer, take away Africa's sons and daughters, and industry catapults into modern army. General Sergeant, yes sir,
yes sir.
And when their old guns jam, them build new toys. Fast ones blast them with the heavy artillery. Attack, 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 kamikaze. Blitzkrieg, air, land, and sea, man, woman, soldier, civilian, all fair game. So them breed, we hate, so them breed, we guerrilla armies. Them teach we mortars, them feed. Them breed we underground struggle because
security is not for me, no. This security is not for we, no. This security is the billion dollar, trillion dollar industry.
It's an advance, they call this progress. It's an advance, they call this
progress.
Progress,
progress.
And now, 21st century is war. And scope broke exponential from Arctic espionage to desert dunes, from jungle to city streets. If not war, it's revolution. Why? Because everybody knows they're other now. Everybody knows they're other now. They're born to war, they're taught to hate. They grow to know their enemy. Across the way, the fence, the land, the tracks, the sea, or state. How did we get? How did we get this far? The Jew would need a PhD in my own nation's history to understand. My people struggle, we struggle. I am from Cuba, I am from Palestine, I am First Nations, I'm from Afghanistan, I am Sri Lankan. Listen man, I am from anywhere you can't go. It's not safe, yo, I can't play in my streets all day. Tried to find a playground in my town. Tried to find a safe place to rest your head, not my bed. And don't drink the water here. There are no ghouls at high noon in my town. There are no ghouls, it's poverty, airstrike, genocide, news media on TV.
On July 16th, a demo took place in Montreal that was in solidarity with the California hunger strike. Elise Eisenkraft Klein from CQUT brings us audio from that demo.
On July 1st, thousands of prisoners in long-term isolation units in California prisons began a hunger strike. For many, this strike is an indefinite one. These men are held in their cells for 22.5 to 24 hours per day, most of them for having been labeled active gang members, often based on false information, for instance, the labeling of self-help or cultural groups as gangs. They are served unsanitary and unwholesome food, punished collectively for the actions of individuals, and routinely and without reason denied access to basic programs and amenities, including self-help and educational programs, one phone call per week, and warm clothing. In response to these conditions, these prisoners have united to put their own lives on the line. As one prisoner explained, no one wants to die, yet under this current system of what amounts to intense torture, what choice do we have? If one is to die, it will be on our own terms. The prisoners' demands are as follows. First of all, eliminating group punishments, abolishing the debriefing policy, and modifying active-inactive gang status criteria, complying with the recommendations of the U.S. Commission on Safety and Abuse in Prisons regarding an end to long-term solitary confinement, providing adequate food, expanding and providing constructive programs and privileges for indefinite SHU inmates. The U.S. now holds over 2 million prisoners, almost 100,000 of them, in isolation. Meanwhile, Canada is adopting similar crime and punishment policies to those of the U.S., the country with the world's highest incarceration rate. Between 2005 and 2012, the Correctional Services of Canada, or CSC, budget will have doubled as thousands of new cages are built to accommodate a massive forthcoming increase in the number of prisoners. Searching for the best ways to keep more and more people locked up, CSC officials have visited supermax prisons in the U.S. similar to Pelican Bay. I was there speaking to demonstrators this past Saturday.
Hi. So what's your name?
My name is Helen Hudson.
And we're using this opportunity to make the links to expansions that are being planned in the Canadian prison system under the Harper's new omnibus crime bill, but that I want to emphasize are not solely Harper's ideas, like some of these plans were set in motion under the Liberals. So Canada is actually looking towards, moving towards the U.S.'s style of prison industrial complex, where we're looking to lock more people up, that sort of tough on crime philosophy, where we're basically warehousing large sectors of marginalized people long term. What we're doing today is we're walking around downtown Montreal, Old Montreal area. We're now heading into Griffintown, stopping at contractors that in one way or another are benefiting from and participating in prison expansion. Architecture firms, groups that finance prison expansions, groups that build furnitures or profit off the labor of prisoners that are paid a maximum of $1.50 an hour to build furniture for the prisons themselves. So that's what we're doing. We're going around to several companies that are profiting and making our presence known, and at the same time making the link to the protests that are going on in California right now.
Cool, thank you.
In Canada, there is only one operational security housing unit, and it's in Saint-Anne-des-Plaines, Quebec. It's slightly different from the security housing units at Pelican Bay in that there are fewer long-term prisoners. People usually end up in the security housing unit in Canada, in Canadian prisons, as a punishment for something that they've done, or as a way of forcing people to admit to something that they've done or to snitch on others. But people are usually in for a matter of 18 months and then put back into general population. Whereas in Pelican Bay, there have been people who have been in isolation for up to 40 years. Correctional Services of Canada are looking to expand the kinds of security housing units that are currently in Canadian prisons. They did a tour of one of the most severe security housing units in the United States at Florence, Colorado, as a way of understanding the prison and how it functions and a way of modeling it in Canada. With them, they took a bunch of mortgage companies who provide the backing and the financial assessments in order to move these projects forward. So it's clear that this is more than just sort of a curiosity trip. They're actually putting these plans into effect. On top of that, all of the companies that back prisons on a financial level in the United States often back prisons in Canada as well. So all of the big banks like Bank of America, Bank of Montreal, Merrill Lynch Financial Group, all provide money to either the government or the state or private corporations in order to allow them to finance prisons even further. So those are the kind of the connections that we're trying to draw out.
Okay, and you had stops on this demo tour that you're doing that were connected to prisons. Like, what kind of places did you stop at?
We stopped at Sodexo, which provides food to Canadian prisons and European prisons. They also provide food in a lot of hospitals, universities, and high schools. We're sort of denouncing them as part of the prison system at large for providing kind of low-quality food consistently. Again, looking to make the most money that they can off incarcerated people.
Okay, and this is related to your own research as well, right?
I have provided a lot of the research for this tour, and it's something that I think is really important to understand how the prison system can expand like this, especially especially in times of economic downturn, I think it's important to understand how the prison industrial complex can continue to expand in ways that other industries aren't able to. Largely it's due to the way that prisons are kind of an ever-expanding sort of thing. You know, if you build more prisons, there's more jobs created, there's more industries that are going to then fuel that.
Peter Collins speaks on how the Correctional Service of Canada, CSC, has co-opted Prisoners' Justice Day.
One of the problems that's been happening in over the course of August 10th is the prison administrations have tried to shut it down, and they try to shut it down in different ways. Sometimes they would charge people for not going to work, throw people in the hole. That became more difficult for them, and so what they did is became more subversive in their efforts to punish people for participating in the day. And what they've been doing lately is they've been trying to co-opt the day. And what they did last year was they refused at this prison anyway. I don't know about other prisons, maybe some of your listeners could let me know what's happening at their prison insofar as this particular issue goes. What they did last year was they refused to allow us to print T-shirts with our artwork design on it without signing over the rights to our artwork to CSC, and then they would allow us to print them. So last year I refused to allow them to to have the rights of my artwork because that's an outrageous request on their part. And someone else did give them the rights to their artwork, and so this the prison the inmate committee here allowed that to go forward for reasons that are completely beyond me. And this year it would appear that they've done the same thing again. And, it's kind of a shocking, very disgraceful kind of approach to August 10th when the people who are actually responsible for many of the deaths now are demanding that they own the artwork commemorating these people's deaths. And so, I guess I would encourage people not to allow them to own their artwork and not to buy shirts that are owned by them. It just seems to be completely wrong on so many levels. And if you can't get shirts made, then just cut a black sock and wear an armband. Don't wear an August 10th design that's owned by the prison system.
So could you tell us what happened in regards to this piece of artwork?
I had wanted to do a portrait of Ashley Smith and, commemorate her life. And I guess they had seen the picture and came and confiscated it at 2 o'clock yesterday, which I think was, May 25th?
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, they gave me a confiscation slip saying that the artwork was unauthorized and it was contraband, and so they actually have possession of that portrait now. And I think it's particularly interesting because just recently there was a news report where during the public inquiry into poor Ashley's death, the Guards Union, through the Attorney General, asked that all of the videos which showed their conduct during the the year leading up to her provoked suicide was they wanted it not to be shown to the public inquiry, and the judge ruled against them, saying that their conduct in that all those situations leading up to her death were relevant to the public inquiry. And so when the judge ruled against them on that, yesterday I saw on the news that the union, through the Attorney General, wants the faces of the guards blurred out so that they're not recognized. And and that's the same day that they confiscated her portrait, And I just think it's so indicative of an organization that, I guess, thrives on unaccountability and like a I think probably anybody who's committed a crime on video would also like their identity blurred out from, you know, the scrutiny of a court. Well, I do understand what their motivation is. They would just prefer that the wall of silence and secrecy remain in place and that nothing they do ever reaches the public ear or eyes.
Correctional Services Canada has started preliminary work on the expansion of two federal prisons, Collins Bay Institution in Kingston, Ontario, and Stony Mountain Institution north of Winnipeg. At Stony Mountain, a new 96-bed maximum security unit will be built with an expected construction cost of $20 million. The John Howard Society of Manitoba works with offenders and ex-offenders before, during, and after their incarceration. John Hutton is the Executive Director of the John Howard Society of Manitoba, and he joins me now in the studio. Welcome, John. What information have you been provided about the plan changes at Stony Mountain?
Formally, no information at all. And it could just be that they simply don't see the need to publicize what they're doing because they're not interested in the response. That's the best case scenario. The worst case is that they are trying to slip in something without people knowing. And that's what we would call a super prison, where this is actually just the first step. They would add a maximum security wing at Stony Mountain and then take the Rockwood Institution, which is a minimum security, and roll it into the Stony Mountain prison as well. And then you'd have one prison housing all classifications of inmates. But it would actually create a lot of challenges, and mixing the populations is likely to add more stress, more violence, and more challenges for the staff and for the inmates themselves. And it's likely to also cause a very severe deterioration in the level of care and safety for the inmates at those institutions. Puts more restrictions on both the medium and the minimum security. It might create a wall around the minimum where one doesn't exist right now, which would really change the nature of minimum security. And if you add a maximum to a medium and then bring in a minimum and create this super prison, you're probably going to end up with higher costs because you're going to have a greater level of security for everyone, even those that aren't needing it or aren't getting it right now.
The federal government isn't alone in wanting more prison beds in Manitoba. From what I've heard, both the provincial government as well as the union that represents workers in prison are also talking about the problems with overcrowding and the need. But a lot of the need is also coming from the federal government's tough-on-crime mm-hmm. policies. Is there any evidence that these policies will reduce crime or make Manitoba safer?
Absolutely not. The government hasn't presented any evidence. Nor is there any evidence to show that incarcerating people for longer periods of time, imposing minimum sentences, making it harder for people to get a parole, to get their parole, these are the three basic components of the so-called tough on crime, or what I refer to as a punitive approach to crime, have any effect on the on crime rates at all. The government hasn't produced any evidence to show it'll make a difference, and in the United States, where this has been going on for 30 years, not only have they abandoned this particular approach as being totally unworkable and hugely expensive, there was no benefit.
Thank you to Josh Brandon and Karen McIntosh from CKUW in Winnipeg for sharing that interview, and now we will hear an interview by Anne Hansen with Robin from EPIC about prison expansion in Kingston.
So as you know, Kingston has the highest concentration of prisons of any city in Canada, with 7 prisons in this area. According to Kingston Economic Development Corporation, KETCO, Correctional Services of Canada, employs almost 4,200 people in town, making it the third largest employer here. Proponents building new prisons or expanding existing prisons suggest such projects will boost the local economy and create new jobs, but the evidence says otherwise. And you can look at case studies from the California Prison Moratorium Project for more information about that. To address the myth that prison expansion will mean a lot of new jobs for Kingston residents or economic benefits to local businesses, it's likely that a lot of the new jobs will go to outside applicants. Many of the jobs, such as construction, will be short-term. Few of the contracts for prison design, construction, maintenance, and services will go to local businesses. And you can see that by looking at the contracts that have been awarded so far. The design contracts for Bath and Collins Bay have been awarded to Noor Limited, based in Ottawa. The design contract for expansion at Millhaven has gone to Parkin Architects Limited, based in Toronto. The fencing and site preparation contract for Bath has been awarded to Peninsula Construction, located in Fawn Hill, Ontario. And finally, the fencing and site prep contract for Collins Bay has gone to S.A. Sutcliffe Excavating, located in Bethany, Ontario. So as far as I know so far, not a single contract has actually gone to a Kingston business. There will be short-term construction jobs that will go to Kingston residents likely, but all the profits coming from those projects won't be reinvested in Kingston. It's also possible that incarcerated workers will displace workers on the outside from their jobs. In my job at the PSAC, the Public Service Alliance of Canada, I've heard a rumor that CFB Kingston might begin using prisoners to do maintenance on the base and to also work in the mess hall. So the PSAC local there is concerned that if inmate workers are assigned to do their work, then, you know, it'll end up busting their union. So, you know, that's a concern to me, but greater concern is prison labor and incarcerated people being forced to work for extremely low wages, if any wages, as part of their correctional plans.
On this episode's Community Radio Report, I sat down with Steve Anderson, a longtime contributor to Terra Informa. Terra Informa is an Edmonton-based environmental news program that broadcasts on campus and community radio stations across the country.
I think we're currently broadcasting on 18 stations in 60-some communities.
Wow. So what are some of the challenges and rewards of having to make your show relevant to such a diverse audience, to so many communities across the country?
I think the challenge is always just getting it done on time. But as far as making it relevant, I think that's actually one of the funnest parts. It was a little bit of a challenge when we first switched from being a local show to one that was played nationally. But now that we're sort of getting the hang of it, it's really interesting to see what's going on in all of the different communities. We try to make a point of still being a local station, even, or a local show, even though we're broadcast all over the place, by keeping track of what's going on in the community. So we're still covering local events, just from another city, kind of.
So I guess, what are some of the examples of some of the topics or stories that you've been covering?
Well, a really big one right now is fracking, which is a method of natural gas and oil production. And that's really big right now in Quebec and the Maritimes. There's a lot of opposition to that. We also just did a road trip across BC, collecting coverage of different people's stories surrounding the Northern Gateway Pipeline, which is this huge project that's proposed to link refineries near Edmonton that are processing tar sands, crude oil, to the port in Kitimat in BC. And there's huge opposition to that as well. So,
yeah, actually, I've heard good things about your road trip. Could you tell me a little bit more about that experience?
Yeah, it was really interesting. We were really lucky to get a grant from the Alberta Public Interest Research Group to fund the trip. And it allowed us to spend, I think it was 7 days on the road, visiting all the little communities along the route of the pipeline. And I'm a little bit scared. We've just started editing the audio, but I think we've got something like 20 hours that we recorded that we're going to have to edit down. So it's going to be interesting. But what really stood out for me was that pretty much everywhere we went, people knew about the project. We weren't sure when we left how informed people would be. But yeah, there's a lot of people who are quite worried about it.
So where can people find out more about Terra Informa or listen to your show?
They can swing by our website, which is terrainforma.ca, and it lists the stations that were aired on and the times that we broadcast. And you can also download podcasts of the show from there.
Great. Thanks for talking with me.
Cool. Thanks.
That was Steve Anderson of Terra Informa, an Edmonton-based national environmental news program. Terra Informa is just entering their 9th season and recently won 2 national awards through the NCRA for Best Current Affairs Program and Best Documentary Piece. I'm Sam Kriviak from CJSR in Edmonton, reporting for Groundwire. That's it for this edition of Groundwire. Special thanks to Dee from Prison Radio at CKUT in Montreal for much of the content used in this episode.